Today's date is July 21st, 1997. The speaker is Jim DeLange. The title is Meet the Kicked Out Lutherans.
In San Francisco, where I have served for 16 years, we have three other pastors on our staff, one full-time and two part-time. Pastor Phyllis Zilhart and Pastor Ruth Frost, who are a lesbian couple, and Pastor Michael Hiller, who is an openly gay man, also in a relationship. Pastor Hiller has been with us for 14 years. Pastor Frost and Zilhart have been with us for 7 years. And Pastor Frost and Zilhart, who are a lesbian couple, have a 3.5-year-old daughter, which Phyllis gave birth to. Throughout the history of the Lutheran Church, there have been two ways in which church communities have been organized. I think there's some spots over there, some over here. Just go ahead and walk by. That's fine. It's a nice cushion spot right here. Throughout the history of the Lutheran Church, as I was saying, is that Christian community have tended to form in one of two ways. The first way is when people who already have a linguistic or ethnic connection to one another or a family connection decide to get together and form a church and to have a worshiping community. The church in this case is an extension, really, of a community that already exists. It's just one expression of that community. So, for example, in our history in the Lutheran Church, many of the Scandinavian and German churches were took their place alongside the Swedish club and the Norwegian club and the German Bund or whatever it was. And so they were really what we might call communities of culture. And these communities of culture maintained their ethnic and language and identity. And even after they had made the transition to the English language, they had made that. But the communities remained connected. The second way that a faith community is formed is when people who define themselves as Lutherans move to another place and seek out other Lutheran Christians in order to become part of an existing community. And this is the pattern, I think, that is repeated with most of us who are part of a Lutheran church or a Presbyterian church or so on. And that's what we see as people relocate to new places. They shop for a church. Or sometimes if their ties to the church back home are really strong, tied in with family and with land and with plots in the cemetery and all of these kinds of things, they don't even change their membership. In the 1950s and 60s, and even into the 70s, there were hundreds of thousands of Lutherans who came from the Middle West out to the West to work in the aerospace industry and defense plants during the war. And only about 25% of those folks found their way into another Lutheran community. As we used to say, the Rockies were littered with letters of transfer from Lutherans. That there's always been a third group who do not define themselves in terms of language or ethnicity, or in terms of what one would say a Lutheran identity or what have you. Go ahead. There's some chairs over here. Space over here. You don't want to look at my back. I think there's. Swing around over this. There's always been a third way in which Christian community has been created, and that is is that is when people who have not had anything except maybe a brush with the Christian community at one time in their lives become, over a period of time, or maybe sometimes very quickly, connected to a Christian faith community. And these are the strangers that the Bible speaks about, and that is the theme for the Holden program this summer. We need to ask, who are these strangers? And I'd like to read just a couple of sections from the scripture. This, I think, is a familiar passage to anyone who has listened to the Gospels being read at any time. This is recorded in all three of the Synoptic Gospels, and Luke chapter 8 is the one that I have chosen. Then Jesus' mother and his brothers came to him, but they could not reach him because of the crowd. And he was told, "Your mother and your brothers are standing outside wanting to see you." But he said to them, "My mother and my brothers are those who hear the word of God and do it." Jesus is saying he had a new kind of family that was connected to him, that were connected to the word of God and not necessarily to him by blood. And then, of course, the letter to the Ephesians, which we've been hearing a lot of, and this one is the theme that is descriptive of the Holden experience this summer. In Ephesians chapter 2, verse 11. "So then remember that at one time you Gentiles by birth called the uncircumcision by those who are called the circumcision, a physical circumcision made in the flesh by human hands. Remember that you were at that time without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers to the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who once were far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. So then you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are citizens with the saints and also members of the household of God, built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself as the cornerstone. In him the whole structure is joined together and grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are built together spiritually into a dwelling place for God." And then finally, a reading from 1 Peter, the second chapter, which is a book really about the strangers. "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you, as aliens and exiles, to abstain from the desires of the flesh that wage war against the soul. Conduct yourselves honorably among the Gentiles, so that though they malign you as evildoers, they may see your honorable deeds and glorify God when he comes to judge." This word aliens and exiles is a word that in Greek we would literally today translate as homeless, people who are away from their home and their roots and all of these kinds of things. And probably the best scholarly study on this and most thorough study on 1 Peter in this concept is a book called The Home for the Homeless, by Jack Elliott, who's a professor of New Testament or of religious studies at the University of San Francisco. He's a Lutheran, but he teaches in a Jesuit institution, which I've always found fascinating. This is a very, very good work. And another book, which is translated from the German, which is called Jesus in Community. And both of these books are from the bookstore. But it tells about how the New Testament communities were formed and the implications for now. There are two groups of strangers that the Greek word paroikoi refers to. And these are, first of all, those who were made strangers by their own communities. These were Jews who could never afford to go to Jerusalem and to the temple to participate in the rituals there. These were Jews who were scattered and did not have a synagogue or did not have a rabbi throughout the empire. And so they were just sort of still identified themselves as Jews, but had really been rejected and were at loose ends. And then there were those who were always strangers to the Jewish community, which made up the beginnings of the Christian communities. And these were all lumped together and called the Gentiles. But very often these were people who were also not rooted in their communities, but were moving around. All were paroikoi seeking an oikos, a homeless seeking a home. And they were strangers and aliens seeking a place. And it is to this group that the early church turned its attention. And if you look throughout the in the writings of Paul and so on like this, you pick up all the time on these people who are not not very rooted. Well, it was to the stranger and to the alien, to the homeless, if you will, the spiritually homeless, the community homeless, that St. Francis Lutheran Church turned its attention some 20 years ago. The history of this congregation in San Francisco, and of all the congregations really in San Francisco, is that unlike the rest of the churches in California, which were founded by people who came out from the Middle West and the East in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, churches in San Francisco were founded by people who came directly from Europe in the latter part of the 19th century. And these churches were very, very ethnic and held on to their ethnicity and ethnic identity for a long time after the 1920 McCarran Immigration Act, when the immigration quotas were set up and immigration stopped. And interestingly enough, that these churches were often just a few blocks from each other. Now, some of you come from towns where, you know, you had the Swedish Lutheran Church on one corner and the Norwegian Lutheran Church on another corner and so on. Well, that's what it's like in San Francisco. This particular congregation, St. Francis Lutheran Church, was the result of a merger in 1964 of a Danish Lutheran Church and a Finnish Lutheran Church, which were only 50 yards apart. And the commitment was on the part of this congregation, which had been, both of these congregations had had services in English for years, although the Finnish church still also had churches and services in Finnish. They decided when they came together in 1964, they were going to change the name, and they chose the name to identify with the city, St. Francis, the city of St. Francis, and they were no longer going to be ethnic churches. However, they would continue services in the Finnish language for the Finnish people who still, as long as there were Finnish people there who attended them. When I came 17 years after the merger, they were still having services in Finnish for four people. The church struggled back and forth to try to survive through the years, and started and made a number of forays. And finally, in the middle 1970s, a pastor came right out of seminary who got them to look at the community and got them to start to examine some of the issues. And at that time, in the middle 1970s, there, very within a couple of blocks from the church, was all of the gay liberation movement that had begun with the Stonewall riots in 1968 in New York, and the gay liberation movement, which was a kind of a spillover out of the civil rights movement and the Haight-Ashbury experience, that it was taking place just over the hill from where we were. That pastor got them to look at the gay and lesbian issues, and there were gay and lesbian members who belonged to the church. And when I came to the congregation in 1981, why I was asked by the congregation, how did I feel about ministering to and with gay and lesbian people? Fortunately, a few years earlier, when I was a church executive, I had gone to a conference in San Francisco. At that time, I lived in Southern California. And I was at that conference, which was about, I think the title of it was Homosexuality in the Church, I think is what it was. And all of the bishops of the American Lutheran Church and Lutheran Church in America and the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches, which I was a part, and the executives were invited to this conference. And only one bishop showed up out of all of the bishops, and that was a bishop, an LCA bishop from southern Minnesota, by the name of Herbert Chilstrom, who came to this conference. And he, for those of you who don't recognize that name, Herbert Chilstrom was the first presiding bishop of the Evangelical Church in America. And at that conference, I not only heard things that I had not heard before, but even though I had dealt with gay people and so on like this in my previous parish, I kind of just, you know, said, well, you know, this is just something you're going to have to struggle with. At that conference, I met for the first time gay and lesbian people who talked about their lives in something other than a painful way, and when they weren't conflicted. But most, what impressed me most of all was talking and hearing the stories of parents. People from an organization called Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. And I particularly remember this one woman, Mary Bell Smith, who was from a little town in Pennsylvania and had moved to San Francisco a few years earlier. She was a widow, and she had been in the Lutheran Church all of her life, taught Sunday school for over 30 years, worked with Lutheran Church women. And she had one son, and he was in San Francisco, and he had never told her, and she had never even known, even when she came out and spent time with him and his partner, that they were that he was gay. She was somehow just didn't recognize. And she got to thinking and so on like this, and finally one day she asked him, she said, Don, are you gay? And he said, well, Mother, I always thought you knew. He said, I'm 38 years old, and I always have been. And she said, you know, she said, all I could think of at that moment was all those wasted years. That there was this wall between them. And at that time, my three children were teenagers, and I thought, you know, what if I were in this position? So that was kind of my story, which I told to the call committee and when I interviewed at St. Francis as a pastor. The people there, many of whom were in their 70s and 80s and had stuck with the congregation through the difficult years, had made every effort to welcome the stranger. They didn't care who came through the door. They were just glad that you did. And they had seen a lot of people leave over the years, and this core that was left of about 30 or 40 folks were pretty solid. Together we said, well, what should we do here now? We're together in ministry, and the decision was made that we're going to reach out to three different groups of people. And one was to seniors, particularly the older senior citizens that were living independently. The second group of people we were going to reach out to were the gay and lesbian people who were very, very close to us as far as the neighborhood and the center of things. And thirdly, we wanted to reaffirm our support for a childcare center that had been started a few years ago that was geared, a preschool that was geared to low-income people, and particularly was for children at risk, some of whom had parents who were incarcerated in prison. The church had gone into a, formed a partnership with an organization called Friends Outside to begin this childcare, open this childcare center. Friends Outside is descriptive, you know, organization to be friends to families who are have a family member who's in prison. Well, when we talk about who our church is and who we are and what has become of us, I don't want to go into detail exactly to all of the details of what happened, because that's a session for this Friday. But I would just like to say that, just to reiterate, in 1990, we were asked to extend a call to an openly lesbian pastor as part of an effort on the part of Lutheran Lesbian and Gay Ministry, which was called at that time, to challenge the church's policies towards gays and lesbians. And our congregation, through a number of meetings, decided to be one of the congregations that would call. And as a result of that call and extending that call to, as it turned out, a clergy couple, Ruth Frost and Phil Zilhart, why the ELCA charges us with violating the Constitution and put us on trial. And that trial was held in July 1990. And as a result of that trial, we were suspended from membership in the ELCA for 5 years. And at the end of the five-year period, we were expelled from membership at the ELCA. So we are now an independent Lutheran congregation. What I would like to do is, at this point, is kind of introduce you to who our folks are. And I would just ask any of who are members of St. Francis who are here this week with me. I was here last week, but they were not. If you so feel comfortable to come up and sit by me, and when I come to your picture, why, I will let you speak for yourself if you'd like to be there. Anybody for sure? Jack? In 1994, we were trying to figure out a way. There's a couple of spots over here. One over here. We kept trying to figure out a way during the period from 1990 to 1995 to get our story out to the rest of the church. And a fellow in our church came up with an ingenious idea. He said, what do Lutherans do when they want to tell about their church? They put out a cookbook. And so, of course, we all thought of Jell-O salad and tuna casseroles, right? But his vision was that we were going to have a cookbook unlike any other. And that was, is that it was going to be a professional cookbook put together by, as we call, we've learned to call them foodies, people who are interested in food, as of course all of us are, but especially in San Francisco, where we have one restaurant for every four people. But there are a lot of chefs and so on like this, and Northern California cuisine has become kind of a standard. But also in this cookbook are the stories of the people in our church, and their story is on this. Now, this cookbook has been sold all over the country, and we're very proud of internationally. She's proud about it. Yes, that's right. It's found its way into a few White European House. Kitchens, right? And into the White House, yes.
In Singapore.
One of our members actually presented this to Mrs. Clinton personally. Yeah, and he happened to be having lunch in the same restaurant as she, in Washington. So, anyway, I'm just going to go through this and tell you a little bit about the people that you know have make up St. Francis Lutheran Church. This fell up in the this cookbook, incidentally, is only about three copies left in the in the bookstore, but there's supposed to be some more coming in. So you can get it up there if you want it. But this fellow up here, his name is John Brown. John Brown is an openly gay man, and John grew up in Mississippi and wandered into a little Lutheran church in Mississippi. Can you imagine a Lutheran church in Mississippi? When he was in college, and just loved it, and became a part of that community, and as a result of that, became a missionary. And he spent two terms in Tanzania, and another 4 years in Bedford-Stuyvesant in New York, working as a lay missionary and teacher. And so John spent 12 years as a missionary, eight of them in Tanzania. And then he came back to the United States and got a graduate degree, and now teaches English as a second language in the community colleges of San Francisco. Peter Quam, this fellow here, grew up not too far from here in Tacoma, and grew up in a Lutheran Free Church. Peter's a straight man, and is now, since he was very much a part of our church for about 13 years, sang in the choir and held all kinds of offices and things like that. He was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam. Peter is now president of his congregation in Novato, California, which is a suburb of Marin County, a fairly large church. And this very nice young woman here and her two lovely daughters is sitting right here, Jay Franz. And if Jay feels comfortable about talking about herself, I'll let her do that. Her children are running around here somewhere.
Yeah, some of you met when she was a bear at the orientation. I'm Jay Franz. I'm a single parent of the two children who are here. And I happen to be administrative assistant at the preschool that he was talking about. And we still serve about 40 families. A real nice socioeconomic structure of diversity, which is kind of what San Francisco is all about anyway. And I came to this church because I hadn't gone to any, well, I had went to various churches in my youth, and then being 40 now, I had strayed really far away from any type of church. And I came to this church because at the time, the Polly Class murder had taken place, and my daughter was right about that age, and she was very frightened. And so I felt a need to be part of a greater community which would help her feel safe. And what I found, so I went to this church thinking, well, we'll just go and see what this is like. I definitely had my doubts about church at all. And what I found in this church was amazing, because under one building was gay, straight, elderly, married, single people who were all worked together. So I viewed church as a building, and I found church inside the building with the people. And I really, really love the values of all the people in that church and what it does for the community outside of the walls.
This couple up here in the corner, sorry, you can't. My session last week, I passed out cookbooks. You can all look, but I borrowed from the bookstore. But anyway, this young woman here is a lawyer. She's pictured there with her husband, she came to us a few years ago, and she practices law in a firm down in Palo Alto, but she lives in San Francisco. This woman here is Faye Robinson. She's a straight woman who's just had her 74th birthday, and she came to church because she couldn't take, she was bringing her mother to church, and her mother couldn't get on the bus anymore. This is 12, 13 years ago. Anyway, and so she said, we have to go someplace close. And so they walk about a block and a half Actually, I think she drives, doesn't she? Anyway, so now she does. I think she turned 70. She started driving. Anyway, and so Faye is very much a part of it. This is Pastor Michael Hiller and his partner Arthur Morris. As I said, Michael has been with us for 14 years. He and Arthur have been together about five. They met at a church event when Arthur came with another member of our church to that event. And Michael was a pastor in Pennsville, New Jersey, before he came to St. Francis, and he moved to San Francisco, and before that in the suburb of Boston. Michael is the vice president of the Stanford University Federal Credit Union. That's his full-time job, but he has had a part-time position with us and puts in many hours in charge of all of our worship. And Jack and Barbara Klinger, these two guys right here, so I'll let them speak for themselves.
We started our Lutheranism up here. We were on staff in 1978 and 1979. We were up here for a year and a half, about a year and a half. I was the village potter and Barbara was the village weaver. And it wasn't long before we wanted to become a part of the congregation here, the Fullness of God congregation, which was very small and intimate. It's the first time I ever knew that a woman could be a pastor. And she was up here, and Nancy Winder was here, and just turned me around. Just completely, and I really responded to that. And we joined the church up here, and everyone told us, it'll be easy for you to find a Lutheran church, but it'll be hard for you to stay there. And they were right. It took a while for us to find St. Francis. Barbara went shopping for a church. We weren't happy where we were, and she wandered into St. Francis one Sunday, came home and said, "Jack, we have to go back." And what impressed me, two major things, was Jim's preaching, which is outstanding, and the kindness that I saw, the reaching out to help people, the gentleness, the sweetness of people. We had a number of elderly people in our congregation there, people who couldn't get up from the pews and come to the rail for communion. And these people, these men mainly, would help them do that. It was very touching. And we went back, and we've been there for over 10 years. I can't imagine being anywhere else. I'm affirmed there in every way I can imagine.
Do you want anything, Barbara?
No, that's us.
This woman here is, her name is Betty Kretzman. She's the widow of Dr. O.P. Kretzman, who was the founder and longtime president of Valparaiso University. And she was actually his second wife. His first wife died, and she had known him almost all of her life. They had known each other. And she joined our church back in 1981 after O.P.'s death, and she moved back to San Francisco. She's a San Francisco native. And Betty has been very, very supportive of us during all the years. This fellow and his partner are Rand Allen and Jonathan Olo. Rand is the son of a Lutheran minister in Fresno who's now deceased. Olo's mother is still alive. And Rand's mother comes up frequently to San Francisco from Fresno and worships with us. And he and his partner have been together. Rand is an entertainer and a pianist in the place where a lot of our services where we have involved piano. He also sings in the choir. They actually both sing in the choir. This is Beverly Hines and her grandson, David. Beverly is one of those oddities, a San Francisco native, along with Betty Kressman. She actually lives in the house that her grandfather built. And Beverly is older than I am. He built this house in the middle of the 19th century. And her mother grew up there, and her daughter's grown up there, and her grandson's grown up in the same house. So they live close by. And Beverly came into our church about 10, 11 years ago when her husband was dying of cancer. This is Janine Jansen, this woman here, and she is currently the president of our congregation. She is pictured here with her then partner. And since they parted ways actually shortly after this, and Janine is also one of those oddities, a native San Franciscan. And we always kid her that when she was baptized 50 years ago, that her parents walked right by St. Francis, because they just lived around the corner, and went to the German church. And this is Noelle, Ruth and Phyllis's little girl. And of course, she's changed quite a bit. She's now a pretty vigorous four-year-old, and I think she was less than a year old when this picture was taken. On the back here are Debbie Cote and Carrie Kelly. These two women are internationally recognized rugby stars. Ooh. And they are a couple together, but in their real life, they're both attorneys. Debbie's actually an assistant district attorney for the city and county of San Francisco, and so she's a public servant. The last division she was working in was going after deadbeat dads, and Carrie works in a firm, I think, also now down near Stanford in Palo Alto. They argue a lot because Carrie went to Stanford and Debbie went to Cal. For those of you who understand big game stuff, why that's good. Anyway, this fellow here is Rich Martin, and Rich is a bouncer at a nightclub and also puts together a sound system. He's a young fellow, about 25 years old. And this very nice, a very attractive older woman here is Mari Urban.
Well, I have to keep it under an hour, don't I?
You have to keep it under about 2 minutes. Okay.
Actually, it was the ordinations of Phyllis and Ruth and Jeff that brought me back to the Lutheran Church after an absence of almost 20 years. And in a very serendipitous way, because my sister was out from Mason City, Iowa, and she had heard about the upcoming ordinations and had suggested with a twinkle in her eye that I might be interested in a church like that. I'd come out to her a number of years earlier. We went on a Epiphany Sunday in 1990, and I expected to just go and kind of see what this was about and go home and be done with that. And I went, and I was deeply, deeply affected by the service. When you walk into St. Francis, at least when you did at that time, but still now, it looked like you'd walked into a little country church in the middle of North Dakota, although it's between video blockbusters and Taco Rio on the other side across from the Safeway. And so that's really where the story started again for me. And I came back, and a couple weeks later, attended the ordinations, which was held at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, and there were about 1,000 people there for the ordinations, and I just was terribly affected by seeing the possibility of myself again as a member of a Lutheran community. Having grown up as a daughter of a Norwegian immigrant in the middle of North Dakota, but my earliest memory was going to Sunday school. So I've been hanging around. I live in the Valley, in the Central Valley. I teach at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California. So I have a bit of a commute.
87
each way. But I found that time driving to and from St. Francis has been a good time of reflection. And as I have become more active in the community, I have come to know my God and myself, and my life has been reclaimed. The first time that Phyllis gave the Eucharistic blessing, she used the phrase she uses so frequently, live in forgiveness and claim your wholeness. And I had lived in forgiveness much of my life, but I had not taken literally my opportunity to claim my wholeness. And as a lesbian who dealt with issues of sexuality throughout all of my life, I was married, I have two grown sons, this was a very important message to me. And that's the 3-minute version.
You forgot to mention you went to St. Olaf.
Oh yeah. Class of 1955. I think, by the way, I'm the oldest, no, I want you to hear this with humor. There is an organization at St. Olaf now called SOGA, which is St. Olaf Lesbian and Gay Association. And I am the oldest listed person in the listing of the members of that group. So I guess I brought homosexuality to St. Olaf.
Dr. Irvin also failed to mention that she also served as president of our congregation for 2 years and managed to make all the council meetings and a few other meetings coming this week after teaching all day. This gentleman here is a man by the name of Lee McCormick. This interesting story. Lee is in his middle to late 70s, and in 1943 or 44, he was singing in a choir at a Presbyterian church in San Francisco in the Navy, waiting to be shipped out overseas to the Pacific Theater, as so many men, young men at that time were doing. And in the choir at Old First Presbyterian Church, why, he met a man, and they immediately connected, who was also going overseas, but not on the same ship. And they couldn't tell anybody, and what they did to solidify their relationship, because it was all that was available to them, was that they went to a Catholic church that was open in the evening before they shipped out, and they lit a candle, where the candles, where the votive candles are always out for prayers, and that was what they did. When they came back from the war, they were together for the next 44 years, and were both educators and in administration in the school district until Lee's partner died of stroke, I think he had, and heart disease. But Lee is very much part of our congregation. And very quickly, I'll just hit some of the something about all of the others here, because I want to let Nancy and Werner talk as well. This is Norman Chan. Norman came from Hong Kong. And of course, the thought is always in the Asian community is that there are no gays in the Asian community, because you know, that's only white people that have gay people. So Norman is gay. He's his partner had a holy union at our church. Norman's older brother, who lives in Canada, is also gay, which is very typical and very often that sometimes, I mean, that's very often the case where it is in families. Norman, of course, did not know Christianity at all and was invited to church by one of his professors who's a member of our church. And so Norman was baptized at 22 years old a few years ago, and he works as an accountant. This is Bruce Jervis and Jim Kowalski, who met in the Navy. We're both naval officers. Jim went to Emory University in Atlanta, and Bruce went to Princeton and in ROTC programs, and when they were discharged from the Navy, why, they were able then to come out and move to San Francisco together, I think about 5 years ago, and both found jobs, and Jim is currently serving as the vice president of our congregation. Jim grew up in the Lutheran Church in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania. Where's Ann? Yeah, that's where you're from. Jim Kowalski. I don't know if that name's familiar to you or not. But anyway, his parents were very involved in the church, and Bruce was a Presbyterian, and his parents were very involved in the church. I mean, he went to Princeton, and so they had to do a little negotiating to decide which church they were going to Well, Jim says now, in retrospect, he says he went to church first before Bruce got started, and that's how he did it. So anyway, this woman here, Erna Dennard, has been with us for, been with the church since the middle 1960s. She and her husband emigrated from Holland, but she grew up in the Caribbean. So she speaks Papiamento and Spanish and Dutch and a little French, I think. Okay. So that kind of tells about those folks. And I would like you to meet Werner Bach. And Werner can tell, he's from our church. He's not pictured on the cookbook, but then neither am I.
I'm story inside.
Yeah.
There are stories inside, but yes. Individuals from the church community have written, sometimes right alongside the recipe that they contributed, and sometimes mine is far away from my recipe. But at any rate, my name is Werner Bachmann. I was raised as a Lutheran. I was raised the Wartburg School in Mount Vernon. And
New York.
In New York, right. I'm from New York. And after I got out of the service, the Army, I decided to come to California. And when I came here, of course, I was looking for a church home, and I tried different churches. And the one that I really came across that that made me feel most at home was St. Francis. I guess I liked it mostly because of the diversity of the congregation. The fact that there are straights and gays and people of all the races that one comes across in our country. And I've been there since 1985. I joined on Pentecost Sunday and have been connected with it in as far as the choir is concerned, as far as the seniors are concerned. Enjoy doing current events program with the seniors once a month, or I alternate with Jim DeLang over here. I especially enjoy the teaching and the preaching that I come across at St. Francis. Especially the classes that we have, I find that my understanding of faith that I thought I was born, that I was born into, and that I thought I had a great deal of understanding of, really has come to much greater fruition as a result of my membership at St. Francis. And so, happy to be there.
Werner is a retired teacher. How many years did you teach in the
25.
25 years? Taught junior high kids. So, and they loved it. Nancy Barker was the president of our congregation when we were on trial, so she had to testify on our behalf. And I'll let Nancy tell her story. Nancy and Paul, her husband, are no longer members of our congregation because they moved to Spokane when they retired 5 years ago, but they still are part of us. So you go right ahead, Nancy.
And we'll always be a part of St. Francis. Well, we were transferred, my husband was transferred to San Francisco, and we had made the deliberate decision to live in the city. And a friend, an employee of my husband's, recommended that we go to St. Francis. It was easy to get to. We were living right downtown, and it was easy to get to on the Muni system, so we did. We walked in and we thought, there's something different about this congregation. It's certainly not the typical suburban or country congregations that we were transferred a lot, so we had been members of a lot of churches.
Her husband was with the Forest Service.
And we found it a very pleasant experience. We went back the next Sunday, and everybody was very friendly. And so we ended up joining. We had no experience with homosexuals. Never knowingly really associated with any. The subject had never come up. It was just, life was a different world. And all of a sudden, here we were with, at that time, mostly gay men and very few lesbians in the congregation, but we came to love these people. We just had a marvelous experience there. And there's so much to tell you about St. Francis beyond the gay and lesbian issue. It's such a caring and giving congregation. When you think that, how many members are there now, 135?
160.
You have a budget of 275,000. They have the daycare center for 40 children. And when I was president, we were contributing $12,000 a year for scholarships to that school. We have a sister congregation in El Salvador. When I left, at one point, over a less than 10-year period, we had sent $10,000 to that sister congregation. We had the seniors program, where a part-time social worker is employed by the congregation to work with these seniors. So it isn't just lunch and entertainment, it's working with those people. As you probably heard the other day, that 70 members of the congregation this year walked in the AIDS March. It is such a giving, mission-oriented congregation. I think we have belonged to nine congregations and have not experienced that kind of caring and giving and outreach beyond themselves as you find at St. Francis. And it's an experience. I think when the Sunday I left and Tim asked me to say something to them, I had to thank that congregation for the opportunity to experience Christ and live my faith in a way that I had never had that opportunity to do before. With hands-on working with people. This is a congregation where you step over homeless people to get into the church. And we've housed homeless people in the church. We have homeless people, street people, coming into the church services and having coffee with us. And sometimes somebody has to go control somebody who's getting a lot of hand. But they are always welcome. They're always there. And I guess there's one other area that I want to talk about. And as a straight couple, and Michael Hiller always would say, "Oh, you and Paul are so establishment." And he would sometimes ask us to usher on Easter Sunday because you look so straight. But what moved me most and what causes Paul and I to continue to now in Spokane be involved in PFLAG and other gay issues there is that so often the parents of gays and lesbians would seek us out. And time after time they would come to us with tears in their eyes and, you know, just thank you for being here. Thank this congregation. I never thought my child would go back to church. I never thought my child would be welcomed in church. And the gratefulness of these people, these parents, just, that was one of the things in the trial, hold on and on, which was, but when the bishops and the church leaders said to us, you know, why are you doing this? You know, and gays are only 10% of the population, but that 10% has mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters and aunts and uncles and children. And all of those people are affected by the way the church treats gays and lesbians.
I remember last week after we did a session sort of like this, there were two questions that people came up to me and asked later, and we didn't cover those things this time, so I thought I would say those. Of the congregation, the majority of people in our congregation are men, and the majority of men are gay. The majority of women are straight. So it's I don't remember how many men, I just did a survey and I forgot now how many men there were compared to how many women, but there are more men than women.
Very interesting.
And so that's a kind of interesting statistic. And the other was, people came up and said, well, what kind of alternate services do you have? What kind? And I wasn't raised in a Lutheran church, but to me, it's a very, from what I've heard and seen, it's a very, very traditional service. It's not a way-out service.
Very nice.
People are broke. There's the procession. There's the crucifer. Everything that you're going to find in any Lutheran church, you will find there. It's a very traditional service. And the green, we use the green book. I always forget the name. But what we tend to do, because we use very inclusive language, is that it gets reworded so that we do have a pamphlet, a little booklet, much like when you go in the Vespers. And usually the hymns even are reprinted into that so that people just follow that. Sometimes we actually pick up the hymnal and open it, but usually we do those. And those were the two questions that people asked.
We want to leave plenty of time for questions, and we haven't left very much, so let's do that now. People have comments or questions.
What's the basis now of your? You got a five year period before a decision was made. Now a decision's made. Is that?
That's it.
That's it.
We're out.
Yeah. With no. There's no.
No. The decision of the discipline committee in 1990 was that we did indeed violate the Constitution because we called people who were not on the approved roster, even though they were seminary graduates, and all three of the people that also attended Lutheran colleges, different Lutheran colleges. But that was the reason. So they suspended us for 5 years, but they did that with the belief that the ELCA, which had three national assemblies in that time period, would change their policies. And they did not. And so at the end of the five-year period, then they said that while the decision for suspension was, I think, unanimous, or maybe shy one vote, the decision on to expel us after 5 years was a split vote, 7-5. And just had to be one person voting the other way, and that wouldn't have been the case. And so that's what happened. So we had, on December 31st, 1995, what we call the Feast of the Expulsion. a service, and we were on television again, and our bishop, who was a different bishop than the one was there when we were there, was there. Was as supportive as he could be, actually people came from around the country to support us.
I just like to add one quick little thing with that. Many of us sat through the ecclesiastical trial. Some of us gave testimony. Many of us were deeply moved by the response of the disciplinary panel, who really heard us. I mean, I think it was a 3-day event.
It was a fair hearing.
It was a very fair hearing. I was very impressed with the panel. They took us very seriously. It was very clear that there was anguish in terms of their support of a lot of what we did, but we did violate the Constitution. It was very clear that their decision, and they wrote a very long rationale for it. And they wrote a letter, an open letter, to every member of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I wonder if any of you have seen that letter.
We could not get it published.
The Lutheran would not publish it. It was not disseminated except, I think,
we printed it ourselves.
Yeah. But that letter was a 3 or 4 page letter in which it very clearly laid out what the challenge to the church was. The most distressing part of this whole thing for me has been the inability of the discussion to be raised. It has really been a silenced issue. And so that's been a frustration. On the other hand, the Spirit of our God moves. And marvelous things have happened in the last 5 to 6 years and continue to happen. So we wait.
Somebody else?
You're not the only church, are you? Wasn't there?
No, the other church is First United Lutheran Church, which is a very small congregation. that's in a different part of San Francisco, out in the Richmond District, and which is an older church than ours. That church is over 100 years old. And Jeff Johnson is the pastor there, and he's doing a very good job of building that congregation back up. But he has only been the full-time pastor there since 1994. So he's only been there a little over 3 years. But gradually it is building up.
They were a part of all this hoo-ha. They were expelled when you were...
Yes, they were the same thing, same time. And that whole story and how that came about, what led up to it, is my session on Friday, about how do you stay connected to the larger church when you've been kicked out. Which is what I'll be talking about on Friday.
The First United was, as far as they knew, a completely straight congregation.
Yes,
when they called Jeff.
And most of the members still are. Yes. It's in a different kind of neighborhood. Yeah, Chuck?
Dick.
Dick.
That was our son.
Yes.
I'd like to just say that as a pastor, and my wife and I as parents of a gay son, that we are very appreciative of what ministry you are doing and have done. And I believe that the church is on the move, that this is not going to stop, this is going to turn around. I really believe that, and I do that in a very positive way. And I think to be respectful of the church and the struggle they're going through is very important. I think that's part of the struggle. But I want to thank you very much for that.
Well, we were motivated to do this for about three reasons, and I'd like to sum up with that, is that number one, we felt that our credibility was at stake with the gay community, of which we were right in the middle of, when this came up, when these three seminarians, as part of the story, were being kicked around and cut up, really. And we felt we had to stand with these three brave young men who came out. And also we saw it as an evangelistic tool. In other words, for us to have credibility in the gay and lesbian community, you know, here's one white, you know, pastor, straight, with all the traditions and everything else like this that I carry as a white straight male, as a pastor of a mostly gay congregation or in the heart of the gay community. The other thing was that we felt that we were in a position to make a witness to the whole church on this issue. If a Lutheran church in the United States was going to be first in calling a gay pastor or a lesbian pastor, the church in San Francisco, Lutheran Church in San Francisco, in the Castro district, was assigned a call, if you will, from God. And so we felt called, if you would, as a witness to the whole church, because we could have done this in a way that would not have, we could have done this in a way where we would not have ended up on charges and on trial. But we chose specifically to challenge the policy. And the third reason that we did this, we wanted to give hope to all of the gay and lesbian Lutheran people around the country who were in their congregations and closeted and were in pain. And we wanted to say that, okay, here's a group of Lutherans, straight folks for the most part, who are willing to stand up and be on your side. And I could tell you that a good number of the members of our congregation, gay members, come from strong Lutheran traditions, many from our colleges and graduates of our colleges, and are very knowledgeable and committed and have been. Some of them were youth leaders and others, and I dropped out of the church in some cases for many years. I should mention, yes, ma'am.
Is the church listening at all? The church hierarchy?
Well, not much anymore. You see, they got really frightened, you know. They tried to come up with this statement on sexuality, you know, that said that masturbation was okay and a couple of other things. And they got 20,000 phone calls in one day, you know, in Chicago because of that being just released to the newspapers. I mean, it was just this outcry of people enraged that the church would say it was okay to have sex, I guess. I wonder where this church is. You have hopes for the church. But I don't think that the Church of Chicago got 20,000 phone calls when they read about all of the floods in North Dakota and all those Lutherans getting flooded out. I don't think there was an outbreak of 20,000 phone calls of compassion and offering to send money. There was some, but nothing like that. Yeah.
Was that 20,000 negative phone calls?
Yep. See about all of them.
I think there were less than 100 folks who had anything good to say.
Yeah, there was.
And it all comes from ignorance, without understanding the scripture, understanding homosexuality.
And we don't recognize how enmeshed we as Lutherans are with the prevailing American culture, which has always had a suspicion of sexuality in any form, and associates any kind of moral. When we talk about, I want my children to go to church so that they can learn some moral standards, you can bet that translates sexual standards. It doesn't have anything to do with kindness, compassion, or any of the chief values of the Christian faith. So, you know, we have a wrong set of priorities when it comes to morality. We have to break for that. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
And just one question. What is your goal or your objective going forward now? Are you taking active steps to try and find some redress?
Well, nothing legally. We are staying engaged through the conference and so on like this, which I'll talk about Friday, and starting to stay connected. I think the best thing that we can do, the most important thing that we can do is that we have to be a strong and powerful and authentically Christian congregation that people could look to and say, well, you know, what's the big deal about having gay and lesbian Lutherans? You know, they're... You know, I mean, that's the most important thing, that we be a strong congregation, number one. And secondly, I think we very much need to stay engaged with the larger church and so on like this.
I'd just like to add that probably about half of the congregation now was not there at the time of the ordinations or at the ecclesiastical follow-up. Probably a percentage of the congregation doesn't even know really much about this, except that they hear some of us who are hanging around keep talking about it. The focus of the congregation is not on this issue. I mean, the focus of the congregation is not on what happened in 1990. The focus of the congregation is on doing ministry. That's very clear.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask, who is the bishop who performed the ordinations? What's his status with the church now?
No bishop did the ordinations. When we did the ordinations, there were about, I forget now, was it about 30? There were 30 Lutheran pastors about who did the laying on of hands all at the same time. And then the whole congregation was invited where they were to sort of extend their hands. And that's how it was done. There were no bishops present. We did have, however, a letter of affirmation and support from Christer Stendahl, the Archbishop of Sweden. Yeah. And that was read at the service, by the way. And it's still, you look at it today, and it's a monument of ecclesiastical responsibility, I would say. I would like to point out, because the bell is about to ring here, that when we were put on trial, during the time of the trial, the president of our congregation, and when we were expelled from the ELCA, this woman was the president of our congregation, and they are both St. Olaf graduates. So all the Olafs. We've had that's interesting, is that we're a congregation mostly men, and three out of the last four presidents have been men. Yeah, that's right. So, anything else anyone wants to ask? Please look over the cookbook. There will be, I think, some more in the, that's right up by the cash registers where Carol put it. And you'll find a lot of stories in here. as well as some wonderful prayers and so on.
It's called devotional.
Is it devotional book? Yeah. We wrote it that way, and it's called Those People at That Church. And if you're wondering about the origin of that name, why, the women's group about, a long time ago, before, about 14, 15 years ago, I think it was, sitting around, they were trying to think of a more creative name than the Women of St. Francis, the name which they have now, I guess. So they were throwing out all of these different names, they called this, and somebody said, how about those people at that church? I laughed out of that. So it was kind of a joke that was passed around. So I guess, when the fellow was putting together the cookbook, heard that phrase, heard this, that's got to be the name of the cookbook.
It's also been used a little differently,
yes,
too.
It was also kind of overheard at various church assemblies when,
yes,
we would have our badges on. There's those people from that church.
Anyway, thank you all very much. And stop here.